Bread Splatters, welcome to the Table, our segment where we exchange a movie with one another in this two-person podcast, and we review said given movie. With me, I have Alexis Soto, and this is our first time doing it together. The last one that was done was Snowpiercer and Place Me on the Pines, and then before that was The Witch. And Casino Royale. Yeah, Casino Royale. So check us out every Wednesdays and Fridays. We're going to have a new To The Table for you two times a week. Yeah, I was going to say bi-weekly. Is that the correct term? I'm not sure.
No, it's not. It's not. The term is weekly.
Yeah,
basically
we're gonna two times weekly.
Yeah, basically
we're gonna have a
Wednesdays
new to the
Fridays
table for you guys. So like I said before, I have Alexis Soto with me. I gave him the Tim Burton classic Big Fish, and he gave me Boyhood, the Richard Linklater classic.
Right.
I guess you could call it that.
Right.
We both get 30 minutes each to talk mm-hmm. about the film. What do we like about it? First of all, let's get to the film that you gave
me.
Well,
why did you recommend Big Fish to me, first of all? And then I'll tell you why I recommended Boyhood to you. Is that how it works, or do I...
We'll get to Big Fish when it's your turn, and then on my turn you'll tell me why you recommended Boyhood to me.
Okay.
So Alexis, why did you recommend Boyhood?
Because it's a fucking movie that I fucking love, and I've been trying to fucking get you to fucking watch it. I don't know how many fucking years. Can I say that many fucks?
Well, this is an explicit...
I am not bitter at all, people.
This is an explicit...
I want to say that, okay?
Podcast network anyway, so I guess you could
literally,
get...
I've known this guy for, I don't know, a long time, and
yeah,
this movie's been out for 3+ years now, and
uh-huh,
every time I've tried to get him to watch this movie, he's like, oh, but it's so pretentious. The trailers are like, oh, it's Oscar bait. I'm like Alexis Moreno. It's like, oh... I don't know. I'm on a lot of coffee, so.
Apparently.
Yeah.
A lot of bitter coffee,
no, but
I guess.
The point is, though, I've recommended this film on more than one occasion.
Yeah.
And you've known, it's no secret, I think, to the audience, and you especially, for those of you who've seen BNC, it's no secret this is my number one favorite movie ever.
This is your favorite, this is your Star Wars to me.
Basically, yeah.
So, it's... what can I say about this film? There's a lot to say. It's some of the most trite, convoluted shit that I've ever seen. Mm. It is just the whole 12 span. The movie's way too fucking long. I'm just fucking with you. It's a good movie. It's a good movie. I think a lot of the things worked. I felt nostalgic for certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was one where Mason Jr., which you learn later on that his dad's name is Mason Sr.
Yeah.
But Mason Jr. is playing like multiplayer Halo, and that brings me back. They go into the Harry Potter book opening. That's ripped up from the pages of my childhood. I'm pretty sure with you when you saw Dragon Ball Z.
Oh yeah.
When you saw Dragon Ball Z, or your president when it got to the Obama segment.
You know that was close to my heart.
I know that was close to your heart.
Was very
so,
much close. But then also that Star Wars conversation. Of
yeah.
Father and son.
When they were like, do you think they'll ever make another Star Wars? And I let out a Ron Howard moment. And I'm like, they did. and a lot of things like Patricia Arquette. I guess her name is Olivia.
The mom, pretty much.
Yeah, like she She goes from a shitty husband to shitty husband, and I thought at the end, she's gonna get with Ethan Hawke again at the end. But I'm like, no, and that's a very realistic tone. Sometimes parents don't get together, you know, and that's a part of the circle of life, you know. And another thing, the kid that they got, he's very I don't know what his name is.
The actor L.R. Coltrane.
Okay. I found him very very likable in what he's going through.
You did?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I liked what he was very likable because going in, I thought he was just going to be like a shitty kid throughout the whole thing. But no, he's like genuinely trying. You know, you see him go from he goes from job to job and all that stuff. He's trying to find his own way. And then when he goes into a like more experimental phase, he's sticking a lot of time in the red room, you know, looking at his photos, and he's just observing his art and all that stuff. And it's, he's just trying to find his way into the world. And the way that he explained it, I think he was talking to his girlfriend, or ex-girlfriend now in the movie, he was like saying, you know, I'm confused, and you know, my mom is just as confused, you know, PhDs and everything, and that rings true. That rings true. Sometimes parents don't always have the answer. Sometimes, a lot of things. Like in the beginning, she had this. In the beginning, she's going, you know, she sees a lot of promise in these guys that she's going out with, but then throughout the whole thing, it turns out that there's a lot more layers underneath the surface of these guys that she's going out with, and one's like an abusive drunk, another one's more uptight and more dickish, and another one's more, come on, you got to go out and fuck these kids, pretty much, you know. So you see Patricia Arquette's characters, you know, plight through that. And also another thing, you see a lot of growth with Ethan Hawke's character. His character is more, his character is like the loosey-goosey dad. Yeah, kids, have fries for dinner. Have, you know, all, you know, go to bed without doing your homework or doing anything like that. And you see a little bit of progression as his character goes on. You know, the next time that you see him, you know, the kids are a little bit older. They're in their preteens. The girl, Sam, I think that's her name. She's talking like this and all that. She's like a typical teenage stuff. And then in the beginning, she was singing Britney Spears, you know, classic songs, by the way. And I think that, you see these growths with these characters, and, I don't think it would have been as believable if they hired different actors for each of the stages of their lives. And that's something that, you know, it really brought a more emotional connection to every one of these characters, because you literally it's like watching The Wonder Years or Saved by the Bell or something like that, you know, where you watch these characters from like when they're like in their preteens or something like that.
When they're small children, they start. You realize that the actor.
Yeah.
Both of them, as far as L.R. Coltrane, excuse me, he began as a 6-year-old boy, right? I think I remember that it was around 6 or 7 years of age, maybe 8, but it ended when he was 18.
Mm-hmm.
At least not the actor, but more or less the character begins with him being 6, and then it goes, or 7 or 8, whatever, then into 18. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
But going back to Ethan Hawke's character, I went in a complete circle, but Ethan Hawke's character, at first, you know, he's kind of carefree, smoking in front of the kids and all that, like not giving a shit about like what the stakes are with the, you know, raising a kid. But then you see like little increments of that, you know, he's like, come on, open up to me. I'm your dad, you know, talk, you know, 'cause these kids are like quiet and all that stuff. and they kind of came out of a really shitty situation. Mm-hmm. You say, come on, talk to me. Let's do this. Then at the end, he's like very concerned about, like, you know, the condition of her eardrums or something like that. You know, like, are you going to sleep with your earbuds on? And did you brush your teeth to the little girl, Sam? And just little stuff like that, you know, stuff like that. And then later when you see him, he's full on Bible Belt dad mode, you know, and it's pretty cool. You know, he's like he has a piece of wheat sticking out of his mouth, and he's become full parent mode, as a mustache and everything. And then he has a mom, you know. Mm-hmm. he has a wife, I guess.
He remarried.
Yeah, he remarried, and they have a kid now. And so you see the growth that he had. And then at the end, he's like saying, you know, if your mom would have waited 12 years, you know, maybe this thing would have worked out in the end. But you realize that both parents are struggling at growing, you know, and it's not just. It's not just Mason Jr.'s story, you know. It's everybody else's story. I mean, you see the mom, Patricia Arquette, and you see Ethan Hawke, and they're growing as well with their kids. And that's a realistic point of view, that you see the parents grow with their kid, and that's a whole part of the family dynamic. I mean, they learn a lot of lessons along the way. Like, he learns a little bit about, like, Mason Jr. He learns a lot about himself. Patricia, she's like, you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to be 6 feet under, you know, and just like that kind of self-realization that really, like, wow, that's something human. You know, that's what I could describe this movie, is that it's very human, and you see all that. I could see
it
why
it wasn't pretentious.
I could see okay. I could see why a lot of people would be like, "Oh, this is an Oscar bait film," because it is heavily, heavily ambitious. It is a really ambitious film to start from, like, 2000. I read up on IMDb, and it was like 2002 or something like that they started, and they finished in like 2014 or 2000.
I want to say 12 or 13.
Something like that. And I was like, you know, that Richard, you have a lot of balls to do this, because, you know, a lot of things could change, you know, and it's risky. Over 12 years, one of the kid actors could have died.
You know, Sam is his daughter, right?
Yeah.
There was a point where she didn't want to do the movie anymore.
Yeah, there was this...
Halfway through, she was
She wanted her character to be killed off, but yeah. Then she was like, I guess, she reestablished her interest in the movie.
That's the thing about making a movie over the span of 12 years. It's like, it could have been shut down for any number of reasons.
Yeah, and then Richard told Patricia, don't get any plastic surgery. just like little stuff like that, you know, just that extra measure. And she won an Oscar,
yes, for as supporting
her
actress.
For a role, and mm-hmm. Well deserved.
Ethan Hawke was also nominated.
You know, Ethan Hawke, I think he should have gotten it, because the way that he played the dad, I'm like, you know what, you're a cool dad.
Jared Leto got it that year. But if that's the case, then Jared Leto probably should have gotten it,
because the Academy Board wanted more honk honk honk. But anyway, I digress. A lot of things worked for me about this movie. Surprisingly, I was like, okay, here we go. I'm ready for the sappiness and all. Some things were funny, you know. I
think about this movie, though, and I think that's one of the reasons why it works for you. It doesn't really dwell on being sappy.
Yeah.
It's not a focus of that like most movies.
It's just this family,
yeah,
living their life, mm-hmm. And that's pretty much it. You know, it's life represented within this span of 12 years, and to shoot it inconsistently, because I thought that, you know, I thought that some things would be inconsistent in terms of, like, filming styles, mm-hmm. and techniques and all that stuff, but no, Linklater kept it kept it consistent. He filmed with the 35 millimeter camera, Kodak camera. I think that kind of added to the intimacy because Kodak is known for like small little intimate cameras, and he filmed with that, with an intimate little family camera, and that kind of added this kind of what's the term, I guess, like family video kind of
home movie
quality to it, and I like that. Like there was a little bit of graininess in there too, so that was, it was like somebody took their Sony Handycam and started like, okay guys, let's follow you guys for 12 years and let's see what it comes out to and edit the pieces later. I feel this family's journey of self-discovery, and that was a huge thing for me. I kind of want that black album that Ethan Hawke makes for Mason. I'm like, I kind of want that. I want the unofficial album. They have stuff like Soak Up the Sun from Sheryl Crow. They have a Yellow from Coldplay.
It's a great soundtrack.
Band on the Run.
You know, a little interesting fact about the soundtrack is those songs were handpicked by Linklater as the movie was being made at the time of their release. So, and that's one of the things you have to keep in mind about what Linklater was doing with this film. Mm-hmm. When it comes to all the songs on the soundtrack that you hear, he had really go off on a limb and assume that there were going to be memorable songs. He didn't pick these like at the last minute off the fly because they were hits.
Yeah, but
he picked them as the way. What I'm trying to say is he had to have the foresight to tell that this was a great song worthy of including it, but it also has the added effect of capturing that moment in time. We had already discussed, Kyle, about the references to like Harry Potter and Dragon Ball Z and Star Wars. First of all, he had to really bet that those things were, number one, important to people, and number two, they would be remembered in 10 years.
Yeah, like Halo, still remembered in 10 years. Dragon Ball Z, yeah, still fondly remembered. Harry Potter, fondly remembered. The music scene and all that stuff is still going on, mm-hmm, to this day that Mason goes through. I don't know. It's special. Somewhat, there's something special about that, you know?
Something very personal about the whole thing. You know, I'm very happy you liked it, because this is one of the films... No, yeah, I know. But I found this is one of the films where I've actually had a lot of friends approach me about it and ask me if I've seen it. Friends I wouldn't think to ask about movies in general. Mm-hmm. They just come up to me and say, hey, have you seen this film called Boyhood? And I'm like, why? I already know, but I want to see what they thought of it. And in most cases, I really enjoyed it. It was really good. And I think what you said, Kyle, about the fact that this is just very genuine and it feels real, mm-hmm, I think that aspect of it really allows itself to appeal to pretty much everyone. There's so many things to say about this movie. I think Kyle pretty much hit the nail on most of them at this point. I feel this is a very special movie, like what Kyle said in general.
Yeah.
Because you don't, and it's not really based in like on the ambitious part of it about the whole 12 years thing. That could have easily been a gimmick. And I think a lot of people these days, and even back then when it was released, assumed it was just a gimmick to get people to watch the movie. But when you realize when you're watching this thing is it's not a gimmick. It's actually effective in making sure that this storytelling, the story is being told in the way that it should have been. Because we've never seen this before. I don't recall. It's not like a movie like, let's say recently, Moonlight. Not to single out Moonlight. I think that's an incredible film. But the thing with Moonlight, it takes a different approach, where it's like every the structure of the film takes place across several years, but you get different actors to play the same characters. And we see that so many times. Mm-hmm. With this movie,
it's the same actor,
the same cast from you see Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke themselves age,
yeah,
naturally.
And that's very rare, you know. Usually it takes like makeup and all mm-hmm. that stuff, but no, that's their actual face. That's their actual way of doing it, and that kind of makes it. There's a more touch to genuinity,
yeah.
in that term, and so I physically and emotionally found this. I get what you meant at the end of the film when you saw it for the first time, and when you're like, okay, I have to take a walk, like an emotional walk or something like that. I had to have a cup of tea.
Really?
I had to have a cup of tea.
There was this really weird thing, because Kyle actually, he was watching this late last night, and he was messaging out of nowhere. He says, I feel inspired.
I did feel inspired, and I got some writing done on my project that I'm currently working on.
Let me say this, because this is what I think really works about the movie for me. Is in this movie, I see a lot of myself and a lot of, even though the family structure and situation of Mason and his family is nothing like mine, there is still so much going on that you can personally connect with, whether it's when he's growing up or when he's literally about to graduate, has no idea what to do, and trying to discover all these different things. We are at a point in our lives where we've experienced those things. We've experienced being mm-hmm. growing up and what that feels like and what it really is. But then also we've also experienced what it is when we get there. What none of us really expected this to be what growing up was going to be like when we were small.
Yeah.
And I remember when it ended, it was interesting, because for me, and this is really a personal story, is I was just not in a good place mentally that year. Things had happened, and I don't want to dwell on, but what was so nice about this movie is, because it is a collection of almost home videos, you see this family, you get attached to them.
And it's filmed almost like a home
yeah,
video.
Yeah, pretty much. It has two effects for me. It made me remember aspects of my life. It made me think back to memories I hadn't thought of in such a long time. But mm-hmm. Because of the way it ends, it also just makes you feel hopeful and inspired that because of what you did to get there, you can make it through mm-hmm. and you can overcome. And like I told, like I'm glad you had that response, because I was inspired. I was rejuvenated by this movie, and I wasn't expecting it to. Look, full disclosure, going into this, I was expecting to like it. I wasn't expecting to fall in love with it. I can't. The reason why this movie is definitively my favorite is because of the emotional response it triggered within me. Do you know how you got, Kyle, at the end of Rogue One?
Yes.
You were...
I was sobbing for 10 minutes straight. The way I felt after Rogue One was because it harkened back to why I fell in love with film in the first place. My favorite film of all time, as I've said many a times in mm-hmm. the Red Spotlight Entertainment podcasts, is that my favorite film of all time is the first Star Wars, the theatrical cut of Star Wars, mind you, but Star Wars nonetheless. And at the end, how it tied in with that film so perfectly, so seamlessly, mm-hmm. I couldn't help but cry. I still cry at the end of Rogue One.
But that night in particular was an explosion of emotion.
That night, because I saw like all this stuff. I've been rooting for these people to get the Death Star plans, and then at the end, when it's Leia, you know, and she's the first constant that I knew in the Star Wars universe. Because all these other characters, yeah, it was R2-D2 and C-3PO, but they weren't.
And this is before Carrie Fisher passed away.
Yeah, and they weren't humans. Mm-hmm. The first human that I was like, oh, you're somebody of importance, Princess Leia. And that was when I was like,
it brought you
okay.
back.
And then when I saw her face, yeah, a lot of people are like bitching and moaning about the CG Leia. Get the fuck over yourselves. I saw that and I'm like, it's Leia. And then she said, hope, and it cut to black, and because it was an emotional wreck before that, because of Darth Vader and him slicing through all the rebels and all that shit. But then you get to the end, and you get to what the rebels are doing. All these people didn't die for nothing. The rebels did destroy the Death Star at the end. And my spirit was lifted. It reminded me why I loved film mm-hmm. to begin with, and that was because of emotionalities. It really put me into this position that I was when I was 6 years old watching Star Wars for the very first time.
Now, how long would you say you were sobbing after the movie concluded?
10 minutes.
Imagine that for 2 hours.
Oh, you cried for 2 hours. Wow. Holy shit.
No, I very rarely let people see me cry, if at all. But I'm not somebody who holds back. That's why I enjoy watching films alone, because you get to experience it one-on-one level.
Yeah, it's more intimate.
It's much more intimate, really. But like I told you, I wasn't expecting to fall in love with it, but the minute it ended... Well, I mean, no, not the minute. There were so many points that appealed to me personally, but mm-hmm. I'm trying to see where it got really emotional, because at that point I was beginning the transition process from community college to university. So Mason, as the movie is ending, he is leaving home and going to school, leaving away. And I was about to forego a very, very similar experience. And that moment, and I think...
It was personal.
Much
it was
more
personal to you.
Yeah, it was very personal, because it gave me a preview of what to expect. When Mason is... He has all his stuff, and he's loaded up a truck, and he's about to leave for school. And it's just that final moment. For those who haven't seen the film, think of the scene in Toy Story 3 where Andy's mom and Andy walk into the room for the last time, see that it's all been packed up, and see how she gets. Now imagine this on a much more heartbreaking level, because you really get to see what it is to be a parent and experience that, because, and you see how heartbroken she was. It's like, what's next? My funeral? Is this all it was supposed to be? I thought I would have gotten more out of it. And I remember when I was watching this with my mom later on, and when we got to that scene, she was agreeing. And that's exactly what she felt like. I mean, I know from my personal experience, because I've completed a year at UC San Diego, and I know... The transition was a lot more easy for me than it was for her. It was hard for her. And I think it's an aspect that a lot of us don't appreciate much, is once we're out of their lives, what do they have left? And mm-hmm. it's a sad commentary, but it's like, what do you do at that point? And then when he's driving away in the truck, and I think the song comes on, Hero by Family of the Year. I was bawling then. And then after the movie, just to say to you very eloquently, when the film ended, I was pretty much what Kyle was doing, and a much more, I would say, a lot longer than he did. But because I was thinking about my entire life, and the more I thought about it, the more I realized what I had just witnessed, what I had just experienced, was the story of my life and the story of my childhood. And the more I realized that there may have been some unresolved issues with my childhood that I hadn't faced up until watching this movie. It wasn't until I saw this film that I had realized, man, did I have a good childhood after all. It made me really appreciate and value the family that I had because of what I saw, and the tragedy really of this family is it's a rotating list of people who come in and out of the family.
Yeah.
With that being said, it's also like there are specific callbacks that really just bless you.
Thank you.
That get back to you. Like for me, I know that hit me on an emotional core was, and one of my favorite scenes in the film, when Ethan Hawke is with Sam and with Mason, and they're helping their dad put up Obama signs, and I think he's trying to kick down McCain signs.
He's like,
too.
Here, grab the McCain sign. Go.
And it's like, I didn't have that experience with my father. My father is not a political man at all. My family isn't political. Surprisingly, I that was a passion that I had within myself. But that was the year. That was the election. And that was the candidate that was my stepping stone into this world of politics that I am now seeking a profession in. Mm-hmm. And it was... Look, I can go on for hours and hours. The simplest thing I can say is, for me, and for what I have experienced and for who I am, this movie works on every level. And it breaks my heart that it seemingly has been tossed to the side. And it's not, look, I want to get this clear. I don't need anybody else to validate how I feel about a movie. However, it does make you perk up, and it does make you listen how it is that a movie you adore so much is at some points hated by other people. And it's not as if, like, look, if you hated it, you hated it. I can't do nothing about that. I'm not going to cry over spilled milk. But on the other hand, you do wonder is, like, what is it about that movie that you despise so much? And a lot of people these days, and I'm sure you yourself have heard this, is that it has been widely dismissed as a gimmicky. And, you know, one of the complaints that this movie gets is that why I was surprised that you enjoyed Mason and the characters, because a lot of the people that you and I watch for reviews and blogs and that kind of stuff, a lot of them really were pessimistic about the acting. They didn't find the characters likable at all. They didn't like Mason to begin with at all for the entire movie. And they just thought that this would have been so much better if this were much more scripted and wound. Well, so basically, they wanted this to be Moonlight. And you saw when Moonlight come out, the emotional response that they got. Because when Moonlight, even though Moonlight is great, you know you're watching a movie. What I love about this movie is that you forget you're watching a movie and you start
like you're watching home videos.
Exactly.
And that's
the point of it.
And that's an added level of enjoyness. So final thoughts on the movie is that I liked it. A lot of moments where it worked for me.
Thank God you liked it, honestly.
The acting, in terms of you see these people grow, and that's something that that I don't think that a lot of movies do. You see them genuinely grow because you start from when they're like little freaking tykes. They're freaking shitting their pants still, and they're snot nosed boogery kids. And then you get to their, you know, they're still boogery kids, but they're grown boogery kids. So you get this genuine factor out of seeing them like personally grow. And a lot of people who are like, oh, this is very gimmicky. Is it truly gimmicky if you're filming for 12 years? Honestly, if it was a gimmick, you would make it more scripted, and then make it feel like like what Boyhood did. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I felt like this had a lot more genuinity in it. So
I'm sure Peter Martinez is laughing somewhere in the world.
Yeah.
Laughing vigorously.
Anyway.
At you and me particularly.
Anyway, has he seen it?
Yeah.
What did he
on the Red Letter Media side of things.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So, Alexis Soto, I had you watch Big Fish.
Such emotional movies.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah. I had you watch Big Fish because I thought that this film was one of Burton's best. You know, it's got to be in the top five tier of his movie library. I cry at the end of the movie. It's a very personal movie between a father and a son. And that's what you get out of it. Yeah, it does focus on Albert Finney / Ewan McGregor's character, but by and large, it's a story about a father and his son. And it's almost Spielbergian. I thought that you would be very interested in this movie for what it does storytelling wise. And it is a very different Tim Burton film than you normally see. Yeah, you do see Danny DeVito and Helena Bonham Carter in the movie. But overall, it is a very different approach in which Tim Burton makes movies. He didn't make it under Warner Brothers. He made it under Columbia Pictures, I think. So it's a different way that Tim Burton made it. And I wanted you to see the broad horizons in which he could film things. So, Alexis Soto, tell me what you thought of Big Fish.
This was stupid.
Okay, tell me why.
No. This is great. This is a great movie. It's... Okay. Big Fish is... probably one of the most... unlike Burton films, and yet still very much Burton, that I have seen. Because, you know, the way the movie starts, you expect that you're getting into a very emotional movie. Mm-hmm. And the end of the life of the father and the irreconcilable differences between the father and the son. And then when you realize that half of the movie is literally the stories that the father had told his son all his life.
Mm-hmm.
First... I was somewhat struck, but then it kind of like made sense when like the fantastical, like fantasy elements came into it. Uh-huh. Then I realized, oh, it's Tim Burton. It's not a bad thing at all. It's distracting. I think it actually adds to the benefit of the film because it is so out there. It is so unique and it's so untouchable. Nothing that has tried to go to hit the emotional beats that Big Fish did has attempted it in such a way. And I think it is so brilliant. First of all, I want to start off with the performances. Albert Finney.
Yeah.
Ewan McGregor. I mean... Yeah, they're playing the same character, but like you believe it. You believe that that person is Albert Finney when he ages. The way that I see this film is basically it's such a heartwarming tale because you begin off with such a fragmented relationship between the father and the son. And you really want to understand what it is about the father that the son doesn't really like. About, what's his name? The character?
Edward Bloom?
Yes, Edward Bloom.
Yeah.
And, like, for the most part, I was really... Like, all of the side adventures that he has are very intriguing. And ridiculous, but... very funny and they're great stories.
But you kind of get where the son is coming from, because all this life he's been telling these fantastical stories.
How the hell are any of these things true?
But he's never let the real Edward Bloom show. You know?
The thing. Yeah.
And so he's never felt like he's known his dad.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where you get the son's plight from.
Right. It was just great, great storytelling and great pacing, and just, it's amazing to go from Edward Bloom. You see his life from the town that he was in when he meets his giant friend.
Yeah.
And then when he goes to Spectre, and then when he meets the love of his life, and then Danny DeVito is in there too.
Yeah. Steve Buscemi is right in there. It has an all-star cast.
By all means, yes, it has a great cast. And for me, it was very easy to buy into, definitely. And you really begin to feel for both of the father and the son, because you see that they both have issues with each other that are more or less warranted.
Strained.
And basically, all they've had to know each other with it are all of these stories. And one of the running things for me is, at what point, and basically what the son is trying to find out is, where does the truth end in all of these fantastical stories? Like, what? How much of it is true? How much of it is not? And that's one of the things that kept me wondering when I was watching this, is how much of this is actually true and how much of this is just a little bit of added bonus to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on and goes on and it goes on, but you don't really see until the third act where things begin to fall into place very, very much perfectly. When you see the son visit Helena Bonham Carter, Jenny.
Yeah.
And she recounts the story when Edward came back into Spectre and how he helped the town pretty much Radiator Springs that shit.
Yeah.
Go ahead and coin that term. And you see at that moment, you knew she always loved him, but you knew he didn't love her. And the sons all but had already assumed that his father had cheated on his mother. And then you see in that moment when she leans in to kiss him, and then when he says no, that's the real Edward Bloom. And that's when you realize, this guy's real. He didn't make up versions of himself. Yeah, he may have plussed the stories, but the real catch is, everything you had witnessed, that was Edward Bloom being Edward Bloom.
Yeah.
And at that point, and then when we get to the scene in the hospital, when the doctor, I don't remember his name.
He's played Connors. By Robert Guillaume.
Right.
The guy, he's the same guy who does the voice of Rafiki in The Lion King.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So we get to that scene where Edward had just had the stroke. And his son is by his side, and the doctor, as he is about to leave, tells him the real story of how he was born.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at that moment when you realize, because of how bland and uninteresting his birth was, that I think it's in that moment where he understands that all of this time, Edward had basically not made things up, but there are aspects of which that were concocted to enhance the experience, to enhance his reality with these versions of what he had made. And at that point, he begins to really understand Edward for the first time as to, you know what? Son of a bitch was being real with me the whole time, and I didn't realize it.
Yeah.
And it's just, I can't come up with a word. And then we get to the final stretch of the film. And that's when the waterworks start pouring in. Because, what was it? You know his death is coming. the movie had been telegraphing that, and you know, for you just know it in your gut when you feel it's about to happen.
Yeah.
And he knows it, and so does Edward know it. And I can't think of a better way to help someone who's about to die make peace with that. Because you see his son for the first time.
Tell a story.
And embrace that aspect. And you, for the first time in the entire film, you see these two connect perfectly. And how in the fantastical version of the story that he tells, how they escape the hospital and yeah. the edge of the river, and you see everybody he'd ever met, and as he says goodbye to them, and then how his life ends, he becomes the big fish.
And then that final scene, yeah, when that final scene where he sees Jessica Lange's character,
yeah.
and then he gives the golden ring, which started the whole story,
right.
story and the whole thing. Give her the golden ring, and then pretty much take off as a fish yeah. in the water.
That was a perfectly executed scene, but yeah. then it got better. I think for me, when the funeral happened, it was all very solemn and quiet. But then what was really magical about that is that, what the fuck? These people are real.
Yeah.
They're popping out of nowhere.
The giant, Danny DeVito circus.
Helena Bonham Carter.
The Siamese twins.
Right, like,
Steve Buscemi is there. Yeah,
they're real. And it's like, I had thought that maybe he wasn't. Maybe they weren't real. And then like, oh, wait, they are.
Yeah.
And they're all in that ceremony. And then, and what was really special about this, and it kind of crept up on me. I wasn't expecting to cry, but I don't know what it was. It wasn't that transition when, after the funeral had concluded and you see, Edward's family and then his friends, they're all together. They're in little groups of circles, and they're all
conversing, talking about his legacy.
They're just talking about him.
Yeah.
And out of nowhere, I just began to cry because I didn't see it coming, because it made me realize nothing truly ever is dead. That after you move on, that what you leave behind are the stories. What you leave behind are the memories that you made with all of these people. And, you know, I'm someone
to quote the doctor, we're all just stories in the end.
Right, yeah. But, you know, I'm someone who's very much fearful of mortality, of death. And I don't think I've ever seen something as close as to Big Fish that can help reconcile that fear, because when you realize at the end all we have are the stories, and in the end it's the stories that make you immortal, that make you yeah. live on.
What really did it for me was seeing at the end, like, his spirit lives on,
yeah.
and you see the little fish
yeah.
in the pond, you know, and that's the kind of like the moral. You're just a big fish swimming in a small pond, you know. Like his big personality is not big enough. Is too big for this world. You know, that's basically what I got from it. And the acting from everybody, Jessica Lange, she's great. You have Marion Cotillard, she's in there.
It's a great cast.
Billy Crudup, Steve Buscemi. You have what's it? Helena Bonham Carter, Danny DeVito. You had a young Miley Cyrus in there,
yeah,
stored it somewhere. You have this big old cast, and and it's so fantastical. But then at the end of the day, you're looking at this cast, and they're not they're actors or these characters. You know, you like when he gets to Spectre, you know, and he sees the, you know, all the people in the town, they like the way they interact with them. Like, they have not had company in a while, you could tell. And so when they have company, they're like, oh yay, throw up your welcome mat. Throw it out and everything, and then you get to the part where he's like, you know, in the war when he's trying to get his is Sandra Templeton when he's trying to get her affection. You know, he's like, Sandra Templeton, I love you and I will marry you. And just like the way, little ways that he tries to do it, and it's very charming. And at the end, when he's like in the field of daffodils, which is one of the most iconic moments of the movie, you get this kind of surreal realism, and that's the way I could describe this film. It's a surreal realism. Mm-hmm. And yeah, a lot of the stuff is sugar-coated, but would you rather hear the real version or the sugar-coated version?
I think that's an important commentary that we have to have, is at the end, really, would you rather have the real events of things, or would you rather have something that you can remember, that you can hold on to?
Yeah. Like, okay, for example, you were born in a hospital such and such date at such and such time. The end. Or would you rather say, oh, bombs were going off in the corner, I was stranded, you know, in a coffin surrounded by zombies, but then your mom, she was needed, you know, and so I had to go and, you know, have you, you know, just like little stuff like that is like, they're fantastical. That's all I could describe this movie, is that it's a very fantastical.
And I think what makes it so powerful, and I was reading up on this, is at the time, Burton had recently lost both of his parents. Mm-hmm. This was made, I think, in 2002, came out in 2003. And one of the things that really inspired him is because his father went first. And then a month before he began filming, his mother went. So this was, on every level, as much of a personal story to Tim Burton as it was to... I think this is easily my favorite Tim Burton film I've seen. It's just... it hits when it really hits. Yeah. And it's quintessential Burton on every level. And it's really... It's crazy because, like I said earlier, is that he has a lot of highs and lows. The film he did prior was The Planet of the Apes. So when you go from that to this, it's crazy.
It is very crazy.
And I want to see more of him. And I've seen a good amount of Burton, but I need to see more of his classic stuff. And yeah. I know that he is one of your favorite directors, right?
Yeah. Beetlejuice, you got to see. Edward Scissorhands, you got to see.
Which is why we're doing this show, by the way. So we can see more movies.
So we could see more movies and talk about this, because there's a lot of movies that I've seen that you haven't seen. There's a lot of movies that you've seen that I haven't seen. And for sure as hell, there's a lot of movies that Peter has seen.
Especially Peter. Like, what does he know?
That we haven't seen. You know nothing, Jon Snow. But
what a fraud.
You're a hack fraud. I think... there's a lot of fantastical elements in Big Fish, to be sure.
And but it's just a great movie, and it's great storytelling.
Exactly.
It's incredible.
And the way that, you know, he shoots things, the color grading of the film, very, very saturated yellows, very, very glamorous. And then when you get into the real aspect, there's slight tones of gray and green.
Yeah.
You know, so... that's like the boring stuff. And then you get to these fantastic elements, bright, vivid yellows, your saturated whites, you know, so you get all these colors, you know, and it feels almost magical, you know, and that's something to take from this, is that it feels very magical, it feels very personal, and it is a very very father and son story, and that's what you could take away from it, is that it is a father son story, almost Spielbergian, like I said before, but it really does bring you to this personal level that I weep for joy at the end of every viewing of this film. So
and that was what was different. I wasn't, what you said is perfect. Tears of joy. I was crying tears of joy, not tears of sadness. That's what was really special about it. Is that when that scene happened, I'm like, fuck, I'm crying. the fuck's happening? Like, what the fuck did this come from? And I'm happy? Like, what the hell? Some kind of inside out shit just happened out of nowhere. And I'm like, damn. This was great. I loved it.
I loved it too. I liked it.
Why do you have to every damn show? Like, just give the poor girl a break already. Seriously.
We love you, Alexis Moreno. But anyway, how long have we talked about this? Only 19 minutes about Big Fish.
What else would you say?
Danny DeVito is a werewolf.
And then, yeah, that happened.
And that's great when he's scratching himself in the air. They find him naked in the woods after a large turn, and all he wanted to do was just play fetch. That's the only reason why he's so cranky, is because he wanted to play fetch. That's great. I like how Steve Buscemi, he's like, never show a man a work in progress, you know? And it's just like the most asinine cliched poem. Roses are red, violets are blue, and it's just like, never show a man. And then that whole bank robbery scene is amazing, only to find out that the bank was already robbed before. Mm-hmm. He's like, please don't tell the locals, they'll go nuts. There's a lot of great moments in this
movie.
Well,
when did you first watch Big Fish?
I watched it when I was going through my Tim Burton phase.
I am like, okay. Okay, first of all, for those who are not aware, Kyle Lara is a man of many phases, okay?
I'm like the doctor.
Stylistically and culturally, yes.
But
yes,
I was,
he has culturally appropriate.
I was discovering all of Tim Burton's filmography at the time because I was really inspired by what Batman did.
And let me know about that. How was that like for you?
It was really amazing. It was really cool. I went and saw the next one that I saw was Edward Scissorhands. Edward Scissorhands, I've seen Beetlejuice prior to Batman, and then I went and saw Big Fish, and my dad had a copy of it. I'm like this, hey, do you mind if I pop this in? Sure, pop it in. I popped it in. Amazing. I was blown away with the film. I was, like, captivated. You know, to me, something that truly stands with a film is that if I'm captivated from beginning to end, and I was captivated from beginning to end. And you know, a lot of movies fail because they have a great first act, great third act, but a shitty second act, or the other way around, vice versa. But this one captivated from beginning to end. I was introduced to all these great actors. Jessica Lange, I fell in love with what she does, you know, from this movie. And since then, I've, you know, seen American Horror Story, Feud, and all that, what have you. I really liked a lot of elements of that. And for the first time, I'm like, Burton is art. Burton is art. And that's what I got out of watching this one, because this is like the final nail, I guess, final metaphorical nail in the artistic artistic view coffin, I guess, the way that I view his filmography. And it was like, okay, he's very artistic, and I like what he does artistically. And then I saw Nightmare Before Christmas, you know, and yes, it is a Henry Selick directed film, but look at the film. It's a Tim Burton fucking film, you know? So I saw it, you know, and it lasted into this long love affair of Tim Burton. I loved Sweeney Todd. Sweeney Todd was an amazing film, because that movie is kind of hard to interpret on the big screen, you know, so the way that he interpreted it was really cool. That's why I was so brokenhearted last year when I saw Miss Peregrine's, because I've seen him at his finest. I've seen what he can do, and just it feels like a very manufactured Tim Burton film.
Well, with Burton, I keep saying it's very high and low. Along with Miss Peregrine's, what would you say is part of his discography, or his filmography, I should say, that more or less disappointing? Because there have been other films that he's made that weren't exactly your cup of tea.
Planet of the Apes, his version of Apes, was not good. What else?
Alice in Wonderland. Did Alice you like in that Wonderland.
I found some enjoyment out of that.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not going to even consider the fact that Through the Looking Glass even exists. So I'll scratch that off the surface.
Well, he didn't do that movie, so
I don't give a shit. That's why I was so disheartened by almost disenfranchised by him. Because of what he brought with Miss Peregrine's. Eva Green is in it. Yeah, Samuel L. Jackson is in it. But that's the only thing that's interesting about the film is that these two people are in it that I like. It's that thing I like. And what really disheartened me is that I felt no enjoyment out of...
But you like Big Eyes.
I like Big Eyes. Yeah, there's a lot of things that...
Hey, what about Frankenweenie? Isn't that him?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, everybody forgot about that movie. That got nominated for an Academy Award.
Yeah. I almost like the short film version better.
Oh, okay.
The one with Shelley Long and Daniel Stern.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, it feels very student film done right kind of thing. And I like when Burton kind of does that because Edward Scissorhands is almost... it's a big budget student film.
Right.
And that's kind of part of the charm of Edward Scissorhands. I don't know. Miss Peregrine's did not do it for me because it was just like not interesting. It tried to be interesting, but it was failing at every level. So that really hardened my heart, I guess. Towards modern-day Burton films, which breaks my heart because I love Burton. You know, I really love what he does.
The next thing he's doing is Dumbo.
I was kind of hoping instead of Dumbo, Pinocchio. That would be more up his alley because he could do a lot of fantastical things with Pinocchio. But alas, he's doing Dumbo, I guess. He did that. He did a circus element in Big Fish, so makes perfect sense.
Oh, I think it makes perfect sense. Why not? You know, like, he's got nothing else to do.
So. Make his Alice in Wonderland trilogy.
Right. Yeah, I really hope. Look, I've seen more than enough of Tim Burton's great work to really hope that he gets back on it because he has comebacks. He can come back from this. It's just been a long stretch since we've had a really great Tim Burton movie.
Yeah.
I know that there was at one point where Disney was really considering him to direct a Pirates of the Caribbean movie, which I don't know how that would have worked out.
I think that would have played out well.
I don't know, man. It's like I know you and I have very different views on 5 and 4. I think you and I disagree completely on both of those movies.
Yeah.
But... with the track record that he's had lately, I don't know what he could have brought.
It's going to be completely different.
Probably, and
I would completely admire that because 4 and 5, although I like 4, they're trying to capture the magic of the first one too much. And it's just, they capture lightning in a bottle.
Were they trying to? That was...
Yeah.
Oh, God. I can go on for hours about that.
They can't capture lightning in a bottle twice, you know, and that's what the first Pirates of the Caribbean did.
Just to make it clear, when I said we disagree, is like you like the fourth one, I don't like it. You hate the fifth one, I like it.
Yeah.
So that's how, but we both love Pirates of the Caribbean. So yeah, it's like what? So, I don't know.
If you want to check out Pirates of the Caribbean, check out our audio commentaries on YouTube or right. whatever. But anyway. I'm glad that you thoroughly enjoyed it.
I loved it. It's a great film. I recommend it to everyone and anyone who wants to see both of these movies above and beyond.
And I kept on saying, and it's kind of like the opposite, like the way that you were with Boyhood to me.
Right.
Like very reluctant to watch it.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew a Boyhood was going to be good.
Right.
I didn't know if you thought that Big Fish would have been good.
I thought it's just that for me,
you know, so, how good.
Yeah. It's just, I'm very reluctant in general, but
yeah,
it's a good thing we have this series because now it's allowing us to be more open with films and to discuss them.
Exactly. So
like, if you want to watch these, go ahead. I think Boyhood's on Netflix. And Big Fish is available, well, on DVD, Blu-ray, VOD, whatever.
VOD, iTunes. Yeah. Your legal ways of watching.
Right. It's not as if, I don't know, this podcast is hosted by some kind of illegal... The criminals. Sorry, I've been watching too much Lock Her Up, the musical. It's something that, you know.
Okay, this turned very sour really quick. I'm Kyle Lira. Check out our other pod.
Hey, where can people find me? What are you talking about?
You can find him here at Great The Alexis on Twitter.
Great The Alexis on Twitter. Also on BNC, we're doing some brand new Marvel videos. We catch one on Captain America Civil War.
And so, guys, watch several minutes of them.
And also make sure...
sucking the Marvel teats.
You can catch our audio commentaries when we have them every Saturday. And...
almost, depending on the...
If
on the
we week. Have them or not.
Yeah, this week we have Batman v Superman.
Right.
Coming
right.
out on Saturday.
Right.
So, stay tuned for that.
It's going to be also, such a pleasure.
We have more To The Tables coming up. The next one we're going to do is I had Peter watch Metallica Through the Never, and then
you're such a monster. I'll never watch that movie again as long as I live.
And then and then he had me watch Split. So
I don't think that was fair at all.
Could we be very split on the decisions? Stay tuned.
Also, every Sunday, catch our main podcast. Yeah. We have one coming up. Our 60th podcast is coming up this coming Sunday.
60. Holy shit.
And whatever you do, just listen to the first 5 minutes. If that's all you have time, trust me, it is worth your time. The first 5 minutes are absolute magic.
Get ready for the episode. Anyway.
Also, one more thing. Catch Alexis Moreno on More Nonsense. We're having more videos coming on there pretty soon. YouTube.
So check out all our content. We have a shit ton of content coming up soon. And we'll come very shortly. I'm Kyle Lira. Catch you guys under the spotlight. And we'll have more To The Table pretty soon. Bye.
Bum, 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 bum. Mm.